Good afternoon, friends.
Good afternoon.
We are on stage 9 of our spiritual marathon here. And this afternoon, we have yet another inspiring talk by Richard Capsule. So I'll let him go on with what he has to say.
Yesterday, when we were talking about astrology in the vital body, we left off with talking about Uranus, and we said that Uranus ruled or was resonant to the light ether, which is what the Rosicrucian philosophy teaches, and the pituitary gland and the optic nerve. Let's begin from there to get to the reflecting ether. Now, we mentioned that Uranus represented the mystic path, the pituitary path, people who approach the spiritual life more by feeling than by thinking. It even has its own pathway. We have a creative center at one end of the spine in the sacrum and the genitals, and at the other end we have it at the voice box and the brain. And the pathway of the light ether and Uranus is up the right side of the spine. The heart, as we have said, is attuned to the life spirit also. The primary seat of the life spirit is in the heart, and the secondary is in the pituitary body. And it is from the life spirit that the intuitions come that strike directly in the light ether. When we get such an intuition, it is an impulse to do something and to do something altruistically from the goodness of our heart. No thought, nothing. This bypasses the mind and it bypasses desire nature, so there's no possibility for sinning. It can't be contaminated because it comes straight from the life spirit, from the realm of Christ, right to our vital body. And if we learn to recognize it, or if we have enough soul material in the light ether component of our vital body, we can act, and we can act immediately. We call that acting from the blood, because the blood and the heart are from the life spirit. All right. Now, I'll get back to my notes here so I'm not too lost. In the Rosicrucian philosophy, we're taught that the life spirit is the spirit of love, wisdom, of the second attribute of the Godhead, of the Trinity. Christ is its focus. The will relates to the divine spirit, to the Father, and the attribution there in modern astrology is with Pluto. The third attribute is called the human spirit. It is where the self is found. And the self is the thinker. So what we're talking about then is the seat of the Holy Ghost. Now, each of these triune attributes has an activity. The first attribute is willing. The second attribute is feeling, and the third attribute is thinking. In ancient Greek mystery schools, attributed to the first attribute was goodness, to the second attribute was beauty, and to the third attribute, knowing the truth, not necessarily being the truth, but knowing the truth. So when we talk about truth, beauty, and goodness, we are speaking about the third attribute, the second attribute, and the first attribute of the triune spirit. The life spirit is the light in love and truth that is universal. So when Christ, speaking from life spirit, says, "I am the light," he is speaking truly. And when he says, "I am the truth," not a truth or not a principle of truth, but he says, "I am the truth," this is a very big statement, and that is truly what we expect coming from the life spirit. Now, the light that comes from the life spirit is not quite like the light that we get from light bulbs or from the sun. It's an inner kind of light. It's the same kind of light that we experience when we recognize the truth of an idea. When we recognize that something is true, the lights go on, and there is that experience of spiritual light. The light is from the life spirit, and that is a recognition of truth. So the light that shines from the life spirit shines through everything, and it is tied together right in the roots of many of our Aryan languages. For example, in German, the word for beautiful is schön, which is the same as from where our word shine comes from, or our word sheen. So the idea of beauty, which is a manifestation of the love of the life spirit, is manifest in beauty. It shines through and everything looks beautiful. Now the life spirit is the region of pure truth. So the life spirit transcends the mind and it transcends the self. In the Rosicrucian philosophy, as in all other mystical philosophies, the self is an idea. God is an idea. Spirit is universal. But when spirit is objectified as something that can be known, as an idea can be known, it is like self. It is like God. Now, the self is a product of the life spirit. And the life spirit is selfness, meaning to say it is the common self to all other selves, the selfness. And this is what is meant when Christ is saying, I am in you and you are in me. This is why when we have the experience of the life spirit, even if we have the experience of the life spirit only in the ethers, it is such that we are automatically altruists. We don't have to practice to be an altruist. When you experience the life spirit, you're automatically an altruist. You can't be anything but that. So the life spirit is the source of unity. And that unity, there is a Greek word for it. It is called isomorphy, which means the same form. And in our modern language, the word for isomorphy is symmetry. There are many, many different kinds of symmetry, and each one is as beautiful as the other. And so when we're talking about beauty, it is aligned with symmetry. It's like seeing the same truth, like seeing the same love from many points of the view. And it's like when you recognize an old friend. When you recognize an old friend, you feel good. In fact, if we have the Oranian quality in our aura, people think we are old friends. I've had it happen many times that I have met people that I have never known before, and they look at me and say, don't I know you from somewhere? And it's because you're giving them the love of altruism and they think they know you. Of course, there are people that misunderstand it, because the Iranian beam is also the beam of homosexuality in males. And very often it happens that homosexuals look at you and they recognize the light, but it isn't what they're looking for. And it requires a certain amount of discrimination on their part. All right, we're likely to get...
You look for the one, not the light.
Yeah. All right. So we're talking about a symmetric beauty that shines through the creation that comes from the life spirit. Now, one place that it shines through is through the light ether, and it gets impressed on the reflecting ether. This is the talk about the reflecting ether, the astrology of the reflecting ether, and we're going to get to that, but we're going to have to take a long side trip along the way. In any case, to review, Uranus relates to the light ether, to the pituitary body, and to the optic nerve. And in a symmetric way, Neptune relates to the reflecting ether, to the pineal gland, and to the optic nerve. Now, all of these things you can get out of the writings of Max Heindel, except that he does not talk specifically about Neptune ruling the auditory nerve. I'm sorry. The optic nerve is Uranus, and the auditory nerve is Neptune. Now, in the same way that the life spirit is manifest through the heart and the blood, the human spirit is manifest through the brain and through the pineal gland and through the nervous fluid. So there is a symmetry between Uranus and Neptune, between the light ether and the reflecting ether and the spiritual things of which they are manifestations. That symmetry is just exactly what we would expect. Now, the vehicle for thought in the phenomenal worlds, that is the concrete worlds, that the worlds of concrete thought, the desire world, and the physical world, which is subdivided into the etheric region and the chemical region, that vehicle for thought is the concrete mind. And that is the vehicle for creating thought and projecting it into the phenomenal worlds, or what we call the concrete worlds. And there is a special resonance between the region of concrete thought and the positive pole of the reflecting ether. Now, this is not a direct thing like the life spirit working into the light ether. It is a resonance. But a resonance can be quite strong. There are a lot of examples in the cosmic conception, for example, where resonances can destroy buildings or move objects or things like that. Resonances are a very strong way of conducting force through the lower worlds. Now, the vehicle that is the etheric brain, the reflecting ether in the etheric brain, ramifies thought. It doesn't create thought, it produces ramifications of thought and carries them out. It carries them out into action, because thought, the purpose of the vital body is action. The motivation comes from the desire body, but the actions are brought about by the force, by the vitality that is in the vital body. So there's a resonance between the concrete mind and the reflecting ether. And we know that the concrete mind is ruled by Gemini. Thus, we would expect that since the reflecting ether is ruled by Neptune, that there would be some special relationship between Mercury and Neptune. And indeed, there is. Neptune is the higher octave of Mercury. Now, for just a few minutes, we're going to do a side trip. We're going to look at the relationship of octave planets to specifically get at the octave relationship of Neptune to Mercury. To do that, we have to do a diversion, or a divertimento, as they would call it in Italian. Is our Italian friend here, is that correct? Divertimento? I don't like to do side trips, really. This is a short talk, and I don't like to do side trips, but in this case we have to, because there is materialistic astrologers not having the initiate wisdom of Max Heindel have contaminated the idea of activation, and they are giving misinformation. It isn't something invidious or anything like that. It's just that they don't know any better, and they're going according to what they know. Now, in music, an octave is when a note has the same quality on a higher or lower level than another note. The relationship of an octave is that it is twice the frequency and half the focal length for something to become, focal length. So that's the mathematical relationship. Now, in astrology and cosmology, an octave means the same thing. It means the same principle manifest on one level as on another level, but because the planes are different, the way that same quality is manifest comes out different. Since we're trying to get at Mercury and Neptune, let's use that as an example. Now, the most common way that octaves are understood in music. We understand them through parallel planes. Every so many planes, there is an octave relationship. The way they occur in our evolutionary creation is through reflective projection. And now we have this klutzy diagram, which is a two-dimensional representation of spiritual worlds that are multidimensional. This line here is between concrete thought and abstract thought. Everything in this direction is primarily spirit and universal. And everything on this side is more matter, and it is concrete or limited. At the crux, where the spirit meets the phenomenal bodies or the phenomenal worlds, right at the point between the abstract and concrete mind, is where there is the focus of self. We are taking the focus of self to be like an I, the true I. When we say self, I am, or when in the Bible Moses, the Holy Spirit says, I am that I am. This I, as we're using it, is both a lens and a mirror. Let's first look at it as a mirror. Things happen in the physical world and they reflect off of the concrete mind side of the mirror, and there is an immediate response. There is nothing is deliberated. It is almost automatic. And that is how reflection works in the concrete worlds. If you had to ponder everything in your thought before you did things, there are things you wouldn't be able to accomplish because you'd be pondering all the time. On the other side of the mirror, the spirit knows itself through reflection. The selfness of the self reflects onto the higher states of spirit. The life spirit and the divine spirit know their selfhood in reflection off of the abstract mind side of the lens of the cosmos. This is what is meant when we say, I'm reflecting on something. All right? As a lens, it works two ways. The spirit conceives a creative creation, and it becomes an idea, and that idea is projected through the lens of mind, where it becomes a thought, which produces a desire impulse, and that produces an energetic or vital impulse, and then there is a change in the dense physical world. So it is a lens that takes things from the spiritual worlds and projects them into the concrete world as creations, and in those creations there are experiences. And when the experiences are completed, they go through the lens the other way. In the process of remembering, especially in the remembering that we do in retrospection, we take the essence of experience without having to take all of the forms and all of the things that go along with experience into our spiritual consciousness by focusing it through the mind in the memory process. All right, so we have seen in a very brief way, this is a very shallow presentation, it's not very thorough or comprehensive, but we have an idea of how the lens of mind or how things go through self. Just a second ago, we talked about Uranus. Uranus bypasses all of this. It bypasses the lens, and the Uranian life spirit intuitions go right straight from the life spirit to the vital body, and in that way they have both the quality of immediacy and they have the quality of not being changed by our personal consciousness. All right, no, probably we. All right. We are now at the point where we're talking about using the center of our being in projection. We're talking about it as being a lens. Now, a peculiar thing happens with a lens. A lens inverts everything. Everything in the spiritual world relative to the way we see things here in the material world is inverted. Backwards. Now, whether we realize it or not, our view of the world is inverted. We see, because of the lens of our eyes, we see things upside down. But when the spirit is interpenetrating in the body, it understands it isn't that way, and it inverts it in consciousness. There have been experiments where they take people, where they put goggles on them, and with those goggles, they see everything upside down. And they have a really hard time even walking across the room like this because everything is upside down. But after several hours, something clicks in the consciousness and they make the inversion again and they see everything right side up. Then they take the goggles off and they see everything upside down again. And when they see everything upside down again, they have the same problems until all at once the spirit understands what's going on and it makes the adjustment and they see things right side up. This is one of the things that should bring great appreciation out of us, because we really don't realize how much is taken care of by the spirit. The intelligence of the spirit within us and what it does for our being is quite wondrous. And we should all be almost singing songs of gratitude all of the time for the wonderful things that are done for us. All right, now we're just about ready to get back to the astrology. Now, we're saying that Pluto represents the indomitable will of the divine spirit. The life spirit, which rules the light ether and all of that, is ruled by Uranus. But there's a physical Uranus out in the heavens, which is somewhere in the concrete realms. So there are two Uranuses. There is the transcendent Uranus that represents life spirit. And then there is the phenomenal Uranus, which represents the phenomenal things that Uranus does in the world. Now, if we look at this, as Max Heindel does, we get the true picture of things. We say that Uranus is the higher octave of Venus, because Uranian love is divine love, and it is altruistic love. The Venus love is a human love, individual for individual. So one is the octave of the other, and they are both the feeling of some octave of love. But when Uranus goes through the lens, its gender gets inverted. And the inverted gender of Uranus is, it's a planet that deals with electronics and electromechanical things. And this has led materialistic astrologers to think, whoa, Uranus must be the octave of Mercury. But they don't understand the phenomenal thing that takes place when there is the inversion. Now, Max Heindel told us that Uranus is the octave of Venus. But we have to test these things out. And in my entire career, I was a computer support person for scientific research. And in my entire career, I had to work with electrical engineers and electronics technicians. Very Iranian people. And if you watched how they worked, and if you talked to them, they did not do it with their mind. They did it by, if they were diagnosing a printed circuit or something like that, they intuited. And they got it by the feel. And then they did the back thinking to get to the reality. So I even, for a while, I was, when I was a young person, I worked in a garage. When I, right after I had a mystical experience, I was living in Tucson, Arizona, and I was working in a garage, and I was also working for the Borden's Milk Company, washing milk trucks, because I had a very serious illness and a hospital bill that I had to pay. But I started talking to the mechanics, and the Oranian mechanics did not work by intellect. They worked by feel. So my own checking out of what Max Heindel says, he's right on. He gets it exactly. Similarly, with Neptune, Neptune represents the higher thinker. It represents that chaotic kind of thought where it can understand all the principles at the same time. It makes all kinds. Neptune makes all kinds of connections. It's not pure truth with Neptune, but with Neptune, the truth comes through association of many things put together. So the abstract mind, where the self is located, is co-ruled by Jupiter, Neptune, and the Sun. The abstracting abilities are Jupiterian. The human spirit qualities that does that creation in chaos is ruled by Neptune, and the self quality is ruled by the Sun. And if you go back and look at diagrams from the very ancient Hindus, they show Shiv, who is the third member of the Hindu. There's Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiv. If you look at the throne of Shiv, it has all three symbols of the Jupiter, Neptune, and the Sun in it. Max Heindel knew what he was talking about when he was talking about these things. Now, on the higher octave, Neptune is a spiritual masculine. Mystic quality of Uranus that does everything by acceptance of love and acceptance of truth. Neptune is the planet of magic. It is of wanting to control the divine forces. And so it's quite sanguine in its nature. It's quite fierce in wanting to do things that way. The lower octave of Neptune is Mercury. Mercury is concrete thinking, just as Neptune is associated with the region of abstract thought. But the lower form of Neptune is very passive. It's like the passivity of mediumship, or it's like the passivity of drug takers who, they have pipe dreams. They just lay there and have visions. So we can see that the gender of Neptune changes. It's the planet of cosmetics. Whether we know it or not, the word cosmology is from the same root that cosmetics are from. And so it's camouflage, it's fakery, and it's all of those kinds. It's dissembling. And the common thing between Neptune a higher and Neptune lower is a mental activity. It's a scheming type of mental activity in the lower Neptune. So Max Heindel again rightly says that Neptune is the octave of Mercury, and he does not get confused the way materialistic astrologers, who don't know anything about the lens of mind and they don't know anything about the transcendent worlds, and it's not, you can't blame them. They're just working with what they have. It's just that they don't have enough to come to a proper conclusion. Okay, we don't have enough time to look into the relationship of Pluto to Mars, because that would be way much of a distraction. So we have noted now that there's a close harmonic relationship between concrete thought and reflecting ether, and that is symbolized between Neptune and Mercury. The closeness is obvious in different ways. Nature of concrete thought is a world of pitch. It's a world of thought. And Mercury is a planet that is sensitive to pitch. The golden ears people that they use for testing stereo devices are very strongly mercurial types of people. Another way of looking at this is that both the world of concrete thought and the reflecting ether have memories of nature, which is highly mercurial. There's the etheric memory of nature, individually we have in each of our vital bodies, and there's one in the ethers at large, and then there is the memory of nature in the region of concrete thought. And so we can see that, again, all of this shows that Max Heindel knew exactly what he was talking about. Now, we've been saying that all of the ethers are polarized. And it seems that they are polarized because the positive poles relate to the higher vehicles. They relate to the desire body and the mind. And that the lower poles, or the negative poles, relate to the dense physical world, which is an outer world compared to the other realms, which are inner worlds. The value of the desire world is inward. When you read someone's aura, you know what they're feeling because you feel it inside of yourself. Whereas when we do something in the dense physical realm, it's always external and we're always working on the outside. There are some chairs if you want to come in. This is why this relationship of inwardness to outwardness, the Max Heindel claims that in the next step of evolution, when we are functioning in the ethers, we will have what is now polarity, will be a throughness. We'll be able to see through things, and there will be a new element associated with that throughness. All right. The polarity in the ethers is very interesting. It loosens the more you go into the spiritual worlds. Like, for example, in the chemical ether, which is responsible for inorganic interactions, the bonds are formed quite strongly, and they're distinct, and they happen right away. When you get to the life ether, the organic chemistry, it's a slower sort of thing, and there are those many possibilities with the carbon rings. But even in the reproductive activity of the life ether, it's there. Like, for example, in Mexico, in the streams in Mexico, there are fishes, and these fish are all female. But when it is time for them to reproduce, some of them turn into males. And when they are males, they fertilize the eggs, and then they turn back into being females again. So this shows us very clearly what the Rosicrucian philosophy implies, is that as you go up in the ethers, things become more and more loose in the polarization. When you come to the light ether, the light ether has to do with coloration and sense perception, and sense perception is quite far separated from the heart system, for example. Or there are beings that have colorations in only parts of their body and respond to the light ether in only parts. This is again an indication that the polarization is much looser in the light ether. This is supposed to be a talk about the reflecting ether, and in the reflecting ether, it is much more so. It is much more so that the poles are almost antagonistic to each other. Because a person who is in memory has a very hard time thinking. If you're working on memorizing something, or you're holding something in your memory, you can't think. And on the other hand, people who are deep thinkers have a hard time remembering. We say these people are abstracted. They can't even remember what happened in the morning. That reminds me of a story. this traveling salesman heard about this Indian that was supposed to have a phenomenal memory. And he goes to visit him. He's way out in the boonies. And he goes into his hogan. And he says to the chief, "What did you have for breakfast?" And the chief first says, "How?" And the guy's embarrassed that he didn't say hello. So he says, "How?" And he says, "What did you have for breakfast?" And the chief said, "Eggs." He thought that, you know, that he'd get him with a real simple question. 15 years later, he's in the same area again. And he goes into the hogan, and the old man is still there. And he walks in, and he says, "How?" She said, "Scrambled." People who are mnemonists. The word mnemonist is one of those very funny words. It's spelled M-E-N-O-M-I-S-T. It's from the Greek word mnemasa. Mnemasa was a nature spirit with whom Zeus, she was the name of memory. And Zeus united with her, and the children of that union were the Muses. You know that this brings up some interesting things. I love to have fun with things like this. Let's see if I can remember the one that I pulled on the phone operator. Boy, I can't remember it, but I spelled out a word for a phone operator, and I said C as in Thonian, M as in, it was M as in mnemonism, A as in aisle, and P as in pneumatic. I have fun. You know, when the people call you as a solicitor on the phone, you can have great fun with them. One day this person calls me up. This is going to be a big side trip, and it's going to put us off a little bit. This person calls me up and is trying to sell me something, and I said, "Where's my $20? And she said, "What $20 are you talking about?" I said, "The $20 that you loaned from me." She says, "What are you talking about? I didn't loan any $20 from you." And I said, "Now you're denying it." And she said, "Do you know where I'm calling from? I'm calling from Fort Worth, Texas." And I said, "You went that far away to dodge paying $20? She got it, and she laughed. And it was a... All right. So we're saying that there's a great polarity in the reflecting ether, so that it doesn't even seem like it is the same realm. All right. Mnemonists work at the negative pole of the reflecting ether, and everything is pictorial. For example, if you give a page of a phone book to a mnemonist and ask them to give you every name back, they'll be able to do it. And they'll say, "How do you do it?" And he'll say, "Well, it's like looking at a library, and on the spine of each of the books is a name." They just don't remember. They don't remember the letters. It has to be pictorial. The letters have to be associated with something like the spine of a book. That's the way the reflecting ether works. It's all pictorial. In fact, it's built right into our bodies, the polarism, such that the right hemisphere of the brain is completely pictorial, and the left hemisphere is completely impulsive to action. I had a conversation once with a neurosurgeon, and it was at a affair where I really shouldn't have been. It was with very, very wealthy people. One of my friends, her father owned 4 farms, and those farms happened to be turned into the O'Hare Airport in Chicago. And he was worth something like $800 million. And his daughters both were students of mine. One was one of the first spiritual astrology students, and she eventually went to transcendental meditation and became very close friends with Deepak Chopra. And the other one became a Rudolf Steiner student, though she was a probationer here for a number of years. And he got injured at one time. He was whitewater rafting, and his head was broken open, and the brain was exposed, and he had perpetual epilepsy and thing like that. He was in the hospital, and the one brought in a picture of Maharishi, and the other brought in a picture of Raphael's Madonna, and the mother's walking up and down the hall saying, "Whatever happened to my nice Jewish daughters?" It was that kind of a thing. But I was at a reception that they had. The daughter that was with Maharishi wrote a book, and there was a book signing, and so I was invited. And it was and so I start talking with this man, and he's a brain surgeon. And he works so much in the bright brain. He says, when I work with the bright brain, which would be with the negative polar reflecting ether, he says, when I work on a surgery and I'm at it for 6 hours, he says, I come out of the operating room and I can't even talk. I have to be able to refocus back into the other hemisphere. All right. I guess we've done enough to understand the reflecting ether. It's time to start looking at horoscopes. This is meant to be an astrology class. I don't have a horoscope of a Nemanist. And if any of you know of a Nemanist whose birth date I can get, I would very much appreciate it. Not having that, I have the horoscope of Marcel Proust. And we'll take a little bit longer with this horoscope than we have been. We've just basically been rushing through these. This is an interesting horoscope in terms of the reflecting ether. This is the horoscope of Marcel Proust, who was a literary dandy in France. He came from the bourgeoisie. His father was a doctor, and his mother was very wealthy. And he writes some of the most beautiful prose that has ever been written. And he was very much celebrated in literary circles, even though he didn't do much writing. And then he became age 31, and he became ill. We'd expect something like that. Saturn is in the sixth house, and we have three planets in the 12th house. This is someone that learns a lot through the experience of illness. And what he did is he retired from the entire literary society, and for the rest of his life, he retreated into his home, and he spent almost all of his time in his bedroom. And he proceeded to remember the first 31 years of his life extensively, and he wrote how many volumes? 15 thick volumes called Remembrance of Things Past. It's a literary thing. I don't have enough time in life, although I'd like to read the whole thing of it. If we see, there are four planets in the fourth and 12th houses: the Sun, Jupiter, Moon, and Uranus. So we can see his inclination to retreats. He needs to be getting away from things. Now, there are two strong conjunctions in this horoscope. One is the Venus conjoined Mercury in Virgo. This shows his discrimination and his excellent ability to work with words. Virgo tends to be very fuddy about words. If you remember, on the first of these series of talks, we talked about Alexander Dumas. And Alexander Dumas had the same conjunction of Venus and Mercury in Virgo, which made, you know, like when you write, you can't do like when I'm talking. When I'm talking, I can talk and talk and talk. But when you write, you have to be very pithy. You have to keep things succinct, or you lose your audience. And this was his capability. What we want to look at is the other conjunction that is very strong. The other conjunction that is very strong is the conjunction of Jupiter and the Moon. They are in Cancer, and that's what we're interested in. Cancer rules backward movements. It rules like the ebb tide. And if we take all of the cancerian animals, like crabs that sidle, or lobsters, or especially crayfish, they all move backwards. Cancer is the most pictorial of all of the signs of the zodiac, a graphic pictorial quality. So if you think of pictures in reverse, going backwards, you're talking about the personal memory of nature that is in the negative pole of the reflecting ether of our vital bodies. So this is someone who could remember backwards. Now, the individual breath record that we have in the ethers is different than the memory that we usually call things back from. It's exact. Every little detail that you can think of is in these memory pictures. And he was capable of accessing them. He wasn't an occultist or anything like that, but you don't have to be so. But he spent all of his time looking at these pictures. Now, the sun is unaspected, and Mars is unaspected in this horoscope. Now, with the sun unaspected, he's isolated. It was voluntary. He pulled himself away voluntarily, and he sought comfort in retreat. He wanted a cozy retreat. Now, the Jupiter-Moon qualities here bring out a special quality. Jupiter is a quality of expansion. So he spent 20 years of his life taking these images and expanding on them, making them very, very broad. We said that if you have access to these memories, you can actually move about in them with your consciousness, and you can carry yourself into the ethers in general through them. Uranus is also in the 12th house, and Uranus conjoins the ascendant. And this was very provident for him, because if he had just written in detail all of his memories, he knew he would lose his audience. So he had to be creative. And Uranus conjoined the ascendant indicated that he could take his memories and he could put them out in the world in a creative way that was intriguing to people. Now, what we really want to get at here, this is going a little too slowly, Uranus was also important to his life in that it brought excitement. If he had, with Mars unaspected and the Sun unaspected in the common aspects anyway, his life would have been very insipid. So the Uranus in this case represents stimulation. It puts some little oomph into him, into his life. Now, what we want to look at is the fact that Neptune, we say, rules the reflecting ether. Neptune is square to the planets Jupiter and the Moon, and in a very broad way, it is almost opposite to the Sun. The squares show that this was an involuntary retreat. He was not in control of it. And his memories were painted with rosy pictures. When Neptune is square to the Moon, this is like somebody who remembers dreams and all the dreams are happy. Even if they're nightmares, they're still happy kinds of dreams. So Neptune-Jupiter combinations have that way of preserving things and making them look positive. And so we can see that is the quality that he had. Because Jupiter is involved in it, he indulged himself. He indulged himself into his own memories, and he did all of this thing for his own pleasure. It's interesting to note in all of this that Uranus rules the 8th house, and he really wasn't discovered until after his death. Most of his books were published after he was dead, and Uranus, in this case, rules the 8th house. All right. We have 3 minutes to discuss the last charts. Well, the next one we'll go through very quickly, though. we only want to get one thing out of it. Everybody know who Rona Barrett is? Rona Barrett is a gossip columnist. She is still alive. We'll talk just a very, very little bit about it. Neptune is near the ascendant and Mercury is in the first house. And when we looked at Uranus being near the ascendant, we said it was somebody with optical nerves that had very excellent vision. In this case, this is an auditory person. Now, gossip columnists cannot become gossip columnists unless they can get information. And they are famed for being able to pick up a whisper across the crowded restaurant. And that is what it was with her. She picked up gossip. She had a remarkable hearing. And she magnified it. She magnified it greatly. And when you magnify things, you know, that's what gossip is. You take a little tidbit. Did you ever read a tabloid? I read tabloids. And when you get in there, the big screaming headlines, and there's nothing to them. Everything has been exaggerated. And in this case, the exaggeration turns out to be very difficult. Jupiter is square to Saturn, and it's in a T-square with Neptune. The Saturn-Neptune indicates that she exaggerates on things that are negative. Very rare that gossip columnists ever say anything positive. And so she exaggerated the negatives, and so much she did that she couldn't stand herself. She's a very highly depressive person. She has that classic aspect of Neptune and Saturn opposite to each other, and that indicates depression. She was so depressive that at one time she tried to commit suicide. I think that she's moved away from a lot of the negative gossip, and I think she lives a relatively happy life now. But when she did the gossip, she enraged some people that one movie star actually sent her a box that had a live tarantula inside of it. Yeah, all right. Yeah. Now we're going to look at two horoscopes. This is because there is a disagreement among scholars. Earlier scholars believed that this was the horoscope of Nikola Tesla. This was in favor maybe 20 years ago. Modern scholars believe that this is the horoscope of Nikola Tesla. This is why scholars need to study astrology. Because the real birth date and time is uncertain. But if we look at this horoscope, just look at Venus. Venus is together with the Sun, and they both square Mars and the Moon. Moon and Venus are very, very strongly square to each other and Mars. This would be someone that would have a horrendous time controlling the sexual function. Just Mars and the Moon being together is an attitude of fluency about sex. These are the people that believe it's a healthy thing. And Mars square Venus are people that believe they are in love whether they are or not, but it's just enough so that it lasts for a few nights anyway. Nikola Tesla was a virgin all of his life. He never had a girlfriend. He was like Isaac Newton. The last words of Isaac Newton were, "I have never sinned." That was what he was. He went out of the body saying that. We're talking about a lot of last words. So this cannot possibly be the horoscope of Nikola Tesla. It doesn't answer to his life. This one does. You will probably never see a horoscope for genius as strong as this. Max Heindel tells us that where the Pleiades are is the spot of genius. Uranus is a planet of genius. The Moon and Uranus conjoined with Uranus in the Pleiades indicates this is magnum genius. And they are sextile to Neptune. And they are trine to Saturn and the Sun. Sun, trine, Neptune. This is the world's fair for genius. It's got everything to it. And this man had the goods. Do you, any of you know who Nikola Tesla was? He was an engineer from what used to be called Yugoslavia. And he was a master of alternating current electricity. But he did all kinds of things. For example, his laboratory, we're talking about the negative pole of the reflecting ether, of which this is an excellent example. His laboratory was in his consciousness. In his consciousness, he would fuse metals together to make alloys. And he would pull the wire out of those alloys, and he would make the commutators and the parts all in his head, and he would make several different kinds of motors and his head, and then he would set them running in the back of his mind. And he'd go on and do other things. And a few weeks later, he would bring them to the fore of his mind again and see which one was most efficient and which had the most problems with friction and things like that. This is an almost unbelievable kind of genius. He was also at the negative pole of the reflecting ether in that he could remember. He knew all of Faust, both books, by heart. And he's just a total super genius. And he had the auditory nerve. This is somebody, you know, that Mercury and Saturn are together with concentration, and they're together in a trine with Neptune, so we can see all of these tendencies toward the reflecting ether. He was a full clairvoyant. He describes in his earlier work looking at objects and then seeing from another dimension light surrounding those objects, and he said that it was distracting to me, but as life went on, he accommodated himself to it and did quite well with it. His auditory nerves were so sensitive that there was a period when he was living in St. Louis that he would be in his study and it would be so quiet that he could hear a fly land on his writing desk. And for much of this period of his life, when the reflecting ether was stimulated, he had to wear pillows over his ears. They didn't have the earphones like we have now. So what we have is somebody that is pictorial, active at both poles of the reflecting ether, capable of carrying out prodigious thought and doing a lot in that way. All right, we have one more horoscope to look at. This is the horoscope of somebody who is modestly active at both poles of the reflecting ether. Somebody who is worthy of being laughed at. This is someone strong in both Neptune and Mercury. Neptune conjoins the ascendant, and Mercury is an overwhelming life ruler. Mercury is sextile to Neptune. Mercury is trine to Pluto. Mercury is almost exactly trine to the Moon. And Mercury is square to Jupiter. Someone extremely mercurial and Neptunian. When this person was young, was able of hearing thoughts across the print shop here at Mount Ecclesia. With the printing press and the linotype running, I could hear whispers or things across the room. I have abused my ears since then, so that the auditory nerves are fine, but the ears aren't so much anymore. This is someone who I've spoken of it in some of the other talks. This is someone who has access occasionally to pictures in the reflecting ether, and capable of bringing some of the meaning out of them. This is also someone that is active at the positive pole of the reflecting ether. This is someone that, you know, in order to make a page of notes like this takes 1 hour of just the writing down of it. And this is someone who has trained himself over 40 years to sit down and print out notes as if taking dictation. that the thoughts just get developed and they just flow like that. Unfortunately, as we can tell from the clock, Mercury is square to Jupiter, so he talks too much. He talks too much and always runs over time, and this is not a very pleasant thing. But this is somebody who is very grateful to all of you for being willing to listen to him through the course of 10 talks, and I have nothing to say more than that, then thank you. We'll take a little break, and at 3 o'clock we'll recommence. Oh, yeah.